Welcome back to the Depth Dive. We are doing something a little different today. Usually we look at the software that runs on, you know, your phone or your laptop, but today we are going into the belly of the beast. Mm-hmm. We're looking at the massive warehouse scale computers that run things like Google search, huge ads platforms, and knowledge graphs. Mm. And we are looking at a very specific, invisible problem that is costing these companies millions and millions of dollars.
It's invisible to the human eye, but if you look at the silicon, I mean, it is glaring. It's what we call the invisible tax of front installs.
We are dissecting a paper titled AsMDB, Understanding and Mitigating Front-End Stalls in Warehouse-Scale Computers. But we're going to be very disciplined today.
Okay.
We're skipping the general overview. We're not doing the introduction to data centers talk. We are zooming in with laser focus on section 5 of this paper. This is where the authors stop complaining about the problem and propose a radical solution: software prefetching.
Which is a bit of a misnomer, or at least a paradox. Usually when we talk about prefetching, guessing what data the CPU needs next, we are talking about hardware. We're talking about circuits inside the chip doing the guessing.
Right.
This paper argues that the hardware has hit a wall. It's time for the software to take the wheel.
Before we get into the engineering of how they do that, let's just establish the stakes. The paper throws out a number that just stopped me in my tracks.
Yeah.
13.8%.
That is the magic, or perhaps tragic, number. They analyze the binary for a major web search engine, the actual machine code running on thousands of servers, and found that 13.8% of the processor's potential performance was completely wasted.
And when you say wasted, you don't mean it was doing unnecessary work, you mean it was doing no work.
Exactly. It's a stall. The CPU execution units, the adders, the multipliers, all the logic gates, they're just sitting idle. They are ready to crunch numbers, but they have nothing to crunch because the instruction fetch unit hasn't been able to retrieve the next line of code from memory yet.
The CPU is starving.
It's starving.
And 13.8% might sound like a margin of error to a casual user, but in the context of a warehouse scale computer, a WSC, that is just astronomical.
It is. I mean, think about the scale. We are talking about fleets of millions of servers. If you can recover that 13.8% or even just half of it, you are effectively adding tens of thousands of free servers to your fleet.
Without paying a dime for hardware or electricity or cooling.
Exactly. That is hundreds of millions of dollars in efficiency.
So the mission of this deep dive is to understand the how. How do they recover this time? And to understand that, we have to understand why the hardware is failing in the first place. Mm. Why is this specific workload web search ad so hard for a modern Intel or AMD chip to handle?
It really comes down to the shape of the code. If you are running, say, a scientific simulation or maybe a video encoder, your code is usually in these tight loops. You process an array, you do some math, you move to the next pixel. It's predictable.
It fits nicely in the cache.
It fits very nicely in the cache.
But a Google search query isn't like that.
Not at all.
Yeah.
A search query touches a massive instruction footprint. The paper notes that these workloads have instruction footprints that are 100 times larger than the L1 instruction cache.
100 times larger. So the cache, which is supposed to keep the hot code ready for the CPU, is basically useless for the broader scope of the program.
It's thrashing. The code is just sprawling. You have deep software stacks, thousands of functions, RPC calls, logging, monitoring, error handling. The execution path is wild. It jumps all over the place.
And this brings us to the villain of our story, the discontinuity.
Right. So modern CPUs have something called a next line prefetcher, or NLP. It's a pretty simple hardware circuit. It assumes that if you just executed line 10, you are probably going to need line 11. And for sequential code, that works great.
But the search workload isn't sequential.
It is full of discontinuities, branches, jumps, function calls. Specifically, the paper identifies distant branches as the killer.
Define distant in this context. What does that mean?
They found that frequently the code makes a call to a function that is located over 100,000 cache lines away in physical memory.
100,000 lines. So the hardware prefetcher, which is looking at the next line or maybe the next 10 lines, has absolutely no chance of seeing that coming.
None. It's blind. The CPU executes the call instruction, looks for the target address, realizes it's not in the cache, and slams on the brakes. That is the stall. That is the tax.
Okay, so Section 5 introduces the solution, software prefetching. The idea is to modify the binary code itself to include special instructions that tell the hardware, hey, in a moment, you're going to jump to this faraway address. Go get it now.
It's basically passing a cheat sheet to the CPU. The hardware can't predict the jump. But the software specifically, software backed by huge amounts of profiling data, knows exactly where the jump is going to go because it has seen it happen a billion times before.
This sounds simple in principle, just insert a prefetch instruction. But as we went through this paper, the complexity of where and when to insert that instruction is just mind-bending. This isn't just copy-pasting code. It involves physics, probability, and graph theory.
It is a massive optimization problem, and it starts with the most fundamental constraint, time.
Let's unpack that. This is part one of our deep dive, the philosophy of timeliness. The paper treats prefetching as a prediction problem with a very strict Goldilocks rule.
Right. The prefetch has to be timely. If you put the prefetch instruction immediately before the function call, it's completely useless.
Because the request doesn't have time to travel to memory and back.
Exactly. You issue the prefetch, then one cycle later you try to execute the call. The data hasn't arrived yet. You still stall. You wasted the instruction bandwidth to issue the prefetch, and you saved zero time. That's too late.
And too early.
That is more subtle, but equally dangerous. If you prefetch the data way, way in advance, it arrives in the L1 cache. But the L1 cache is tiny. If the CPU doesn't use that code pretty much immediately, the cache might just evict it to make room for something else.
Or even worse, the prefetch code might evict something else that the CPU is actually currently using.
Exactly. You cause cache pollution, so you have this very narrow window of opportunity. You need to be early enough to hide the latency, but late enough to avoid pollution.
The paper actually gives us a formula for this. They define the minimum distance D. And I want to dig into the math here because it connects the software to the actual silicon physics. The formula is D equals memory latency times average IPC.
Let's break down the variables. First, memory latency. In the paper, they are modeling an Intel Haswell server architecture, and they specifically look at the latency to fetch data from the L3 cache.
Why L3? Why not main memory?
Because in these massive workloads, the instruction working set is way too big for L1 or L2, but it generally fits in the massive shared L3 cache. If you have to go all the way to main RAM, you've probably already lost the game.
Okay.
So they optimize for the L3 hit. On Haswell, that round trip takes approximately 76 CPU cycles.
Okay, 76 cycles. That is the time of flight. The request goes out, traverses the ring interconnect on the chip, finds the data in a bank of L3, and travels all the way back to the core.
Right. Now, during those 76 cycles of waiting, the CPU isn't stopped, hopefully. It is executing the instructions leading up to the miss. We need to know how many instructions it can crunch through in that time. And that is the IPC instructions per cycle.
And for this workload web search, the IPC is, it's shockingly low.
It is. The paper cites an average IPC of 0.67.
That really puts it in perspective. A modern CPU can theoretically execute 3 or 4 instructions per cycle if everything is absolutely perfect. But here, we aren't even finishing one instruction per cycle.
That's the nature of what they call pointer chasing code. It's just messy. So we do the math. 76 cycles of latency multiplied by 0.67 instructions per cycle gives us roughly 51.
51 instructions. That is our braking distance.
That's a great analogy. If you see the cliff the cache miss coming, you need to hit the brakes, or rather hit the prefetch button, at least 51 instructions before you get there. If you do it at instruction 40, you're going over the cliff. You will stall.
So the magic number is 51.
More.
But the paper introduces another variable, W, the window.
Because you can't always put an instruction exactly 51 slots back. I mean, what if instruction 51 is in the middle of another instruction? Or what if it's a jump target? It's just not practical. You need some leeway. So they define a window, looking from distance D back to distance D plus W.
How big is the window? Can we look back 500 instructions?
No, because then you trigger the too early problem. The paper states empirically that if the window extends past about 200 instructions, performance actually degrades. The cache pollution starts to outweigh the benefit.
So our target zone is remarkably tight, somewhere between 51 and roughly 200 instructions before the miss.
It's a very specific sweet spot.
Okay, so we have the math. We know we need to find a spot in the code roughly 50 to 200 steps back. Now we run into the structural problem. Code isn't a straight line. It forks, it loops, it jumps. This leads us to part two, the algorithmic challenges.
This is where we leave the physics and enter graph theory. The authors discuss two main enemies, fan-in and fan-out.
Let's tackle fan-in first. I love the visual of this. Imagine you are standing at the cache miss. Let's say it's inside the memcam function, which is used to compare blocks of memory. A very, very common operation.
Right. So you are at the miss. Now you turn around and you look backwards in time. Who called you?
In a search engine binary, everyone calls memcam.
Exactly. You might have 500 different functions that call memcam. and each of those functions might be called by 10 other functions. As you walk backwards 51 steps to find your injection site, the number of possible paths just explodes. This is Fanon?
It's like a river delta in reverse. You start at the ocean and try to walk upriver, but it splits into 1,000 tiny creeks. The paper even says top misses often have more than 100 incoming paths when looking back, just 10 instructions.
It's insane. And this creates a massive problem for code size. If you want to fix the miss in memcamp and you find 1,000 different paths leading to it at distance 51, do you insert 1,000 prefetch instructions?
That seems incredibly wasteful. You're just bloating the binary.
It is. It increases the instruction cache pressure, which is exactly the problem we're trying to alleviate in the first place. So the algorithm has to be smart. It can't just spray and pray.
But if Fanon is about bloat, the second enemy, Fanout, is about accuracy.
Fanout is arguably the bigger performance killer. Let's go back to our spot 51 instructions back. Let's call it instruction A. You're thinking about putting a prefetch here.
Yeah.
But does instruction A guarantee that we will reach the miss?
Not necessarily. I mean, there might be an if statement at instruction 30.
Right. Maybe 90% of the time, the code goes left and avoids the function call entirely. If you put the prefetch at instruction A, you are paying the cost fetching the data, using the bandwidth. But 90% of the time, that data is completely useless.
You're ordering a pizza for a party that isn't happening.
And you're filling up your fridge, the cache, with that pizza, leaving no room for the food you actually need. That is a useless prefetch. High fan out means low accuracy.
So this is a tug of war. You need to be far enough back for timeliness, but if you go too far back, the fanon explodes, meaning too many paths, and the fanout explodes, meaning too many branches leading elsewhere. How on earth does the algorithm solve this?
They developed a decision logic, a heuristic traversal of the graph. It's illustrated in figure 16 of the paper, and it's really a series of probability checks.
Walk us through the decision tree.
Okay, scenario one, the golden path, the ideal case. The algorithm looks back distance D, it finds an instruction, it checks the profile data from ASMDB, and it sees that 100% of the time this instruction executes, it leads directly to the miss. And maybe there is only one path.
Easy. Insert the prefetch. Done.
Done. But that's rare. Very rare.
Okay.
So, scenario two, mitigation via dominators. Let's say at distance D we have high fan out. The probability of reaching the miss is only, say, 10%. We can't put the prefetch there.
So did it just give up?
No. It looks further back. It looks at the predecessor of that instruction. It asks, is there an instruction earlier in the chain that acts as a choke point, a dominator? Maybe there is a node at distance 70 that forces the execution down a specific pipe that eventually hits the miss, avoiding the other branches.
Wait, so by moving further away from the miss, we might actually get more accurate?
Exactly. It's completely counterintuitive, but yes. By stepping back, you might find the decision point that decided the path in the first place. If that decision point is still within our window, you know, our D plus W, the algorithm moves the injection site back to that dominator.
That is brilliant. It trades distance for certainty.
It does. Now, scenario three, the loop. This is critical. Suppose the point at distance 51 falls inside a tight while loop.
Okay, so if you put the prefetch there, the CPU executes it every single time the loop spins.
And if the loop spins 1,000 times, you issue 1,000 requests for the exact same cache line. That is pure waste. It thrashes the L1 cache pipeline.
So the algorithm needs to hoist the instruction, lift it out.
Correct. It scans backward until it finds the instruction that sits just before the loop begins. Even if that instruction is at distance 150 or 200, it is far, far better to place it there. You execute the prefetch once, load the data, then dive into the loop.
This requires a really sophisticated understanding of the control flow graph. You can't just look at a list of instructions. You need the map of how they all connect.
Which is why ASMDB is the foundation. You absolutely cannot do this with static analysis alone. You need the historical data to know which paths are actually taken and how often loops actually spin in the real world.
Okay, so we've covered the philosophy and the graph theory. Now let's talk about the engineering reality.
Yeah.
How do they actually inject these instructions? This is part three, the injection procedure.
This is the part that really highlights the warehouse scale nature of the solution. This isn't a developer optimizing their C++ code by hand. This is an automated post-build process.
Why post-build? Why not just have the compiler do it?
Because the compiler, like GCC or LLVM, works on source code. It sees functions in isolation. It doesn't know the final layout of the binary. It has no idea that function A will end up exactly 120,000 bytes away from function B after everything is linked together.
And it certainly doesn't know the IPC of the specific machine it's running on.
Exactly. The compiler is guessing. This system, however, operates post-link. The binary is already built, the game is over, and it has the replay footage.
Walk us through the steps.
Step one is construct histories. They feed the binary and the AsmDB profile data into their tool. The tool identifies every single cache miss. Then for each miss, it performs a bottom-up walk of the control flow graph.
It's mapping the rivers.
It's mapping the rivers, exactly. It creates a history graph for every miss, annotating every node with execution counts and probabilities. It stops walking when the path length exceeds that window limit, that D plus W.
Step two.
Compute locations. This is where it runs that decision logic we just discussed. It recursively compares nodes. It asks, is this node better than its predecessor? Is the probability higher? Is the fan out lower? It scores all the candidates.
And it selects the winners.
It outputs a list of tuples, injection address, target address, basically a set of instructions. At offset 0 by 4,000, prefetch 0 by 8,000.
And step three.
Post-link injection. This is the surgical part. They disassemble the binary, insert the new prefetch instructions, and then reassemble it.
This sounds risky. Modifying a binary after it's compiled, doesn't that break all the offsets? If I add 4 bytes here, doesn't everything after it shift by 4 bytes?
It does. It shifts all the jump targets. So the tool has to be incredibly robust. It has to fix up every single relative branch and jump in the entire program to account for the new layout. But because they are doing this at the binary level, they can be precise.
The paper compares this to static analysis approaches, the traditional way compilers try to help. Why is this so much better?
Static analysis has a fatal flaw, indirect branches.
Explain that for the listeners.
Okay, so a direct branch is go to address X, the compiler sees X, and indirect branches go to the address stored in register Y. The compiler has no idea what is in register Y. That value is calculated at runtime.
These are things like virtual function calls in C++A, or function pointers or callbacks.
Exactly, and in these large workloads, those are everywhere. Static analysis hits a call register Y instruction and goes blind. It can't predict the target, so it can't prefetch for it. Or worse, it tries to guess based on heuristics, guesses wrong, and pollutes the cache.
But our AsmDB approach doesn't care about the source code. It just knows that for the last 5 days of execution, register Y contained address Z 99% of the time.
Exactly. It replaces guessing with knowing. It filters the prefetches via software intelligence rather than relying on hardware filters or compiler guesses.
So we have the perfect plan, we have the perfect map, but now we hit a brick wall. And this is part four, the hardware reality.
A catch. There is always a catch.
The software solution requires a specific CPU instruction to execute the prefetch. Hey, CPU, fetch this code. But the paper points out a paradox. That instruction, it doesn't really exist.
Not in the way they need it to, no. We're used to data prefetching. If you write by 86 code, you can use prefetch 0, prefetch 1, and so on. But those fetch lines into the data cache, the L1D.
And we need it in the instruction cache, the L1I.
They are physically separate caches on the chip. If you load code into the data cache, it's like putting your dinner in the laundry machine. It's inside the house, sure, but you can't eat it. The CPU instruction fetch unit cannot read from the data cache.
So if you use prefetch 0 for this, you just pollute the data cache and help absolutely nothing.
Nothing at all. So since the instruction didn't exist on the Haswell servers they were optimizing, they had to define what the ideal instruction would look like. They lay out 4 specific requirements for chip makers like Intel or AMD to build.
Let's go through them. This is a wish list for the future of silicon. Requirement 1.
Destination. Simple enough. It must load blocks into the L1 instruction cache or a dedicated prefetch buffer that's accessible to the fetch unit.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Requirement 2. Translation. This one gets a bit technical. They say it must use the ITLB, not the DTLB.
This is critical. TLB stands for Translation Lookaside Buffer. It maps virtual addresses to physical RAM addresses. There's one for data, the DTLB, and one for instructions, the ITLB.
Why not just use the data TLB? It's already there.
2 big reasons. First, contention. The DTLB is busy. It handles every variable access, every array read. If we flood it with code prefetch requests, we create a traffic jam that slows down the actual computation. We need a dedicated lane.
And the second reason?
Permissions. Code pages in memory are often marked execute only for security. If you try to read them through the data TLB, the hardware thinks you are trying to read the code as data, which a hacker might do.
Right.
It throws a protection fault and crashes the program. The ITLB has the right permissions.
Got it. Okay, requirement 3, state. I mentioned shared state, or the S state in MIS-I.
MIS-I is the protocol for cache coherence, how different cores agree on what data is valid. M is modified, E is exclusive, S is shared. Since code is read-only, we aren't rewriting the binary as we run it. We only need the shared state.
This is an optimization, then.
It is. Requesting exclusive access is expensive. It forces other cores to invalidate their copies. Requesting shared is polite, it's faster, and plays nice with the other cores on the chip.
And finally, requirement 4, pipeline behavior.
Fire and forget. This instruction should not clog up the CPU pipeline. As soon as the decoder sees it, it should prune it from the instruction stream, send the request to the memory controller, and move on. It shouldn't take up a slot in the reorder buffer. It needs to be invisible to the backend.
Yeah, effectively a ghost instruction. It triggers an action, but leaves no trace in the execution stream.
That's the perfect term for it.
Now, since this instruction didn't exist on their Haswell chips, they couldn't just deploy this to the Google fleet and measure it. They had to simulate it.
This leads us to part 5, the evaluation. They used a simulator called ZSIM.
So they took traces, exact recordings, of the execution of search, ads, and knowledge graph, and ran them through the simulator, modeling an 18-core server that has this hypothetical ghost instruction.
And they performed a limit study. This is my favorite kind of analysis. It asks, what is the theoretical maximum benefit?
They define the gap.
Right. On one side, you have the current hardware with its next line prefetcher. It captures about 80% of misses, mostly the easy sequential ones. On the other side, you have a perfect instruction cache that never ever guesses.
And the difference between the two is the gap. It represents that 13.8% performance loss.
And the question was, how much of that gap can software prefetching close?
The results were, they were frankly ridiculous.
They were. On the web search workload, the software prefetcher achieved 96% miss coverage.
96%. It didn't just improve the situation, it effectively solved it.
It turned the instruction cache into a near-perfect component. It successfully predicted almost every single discontinuity, every distant branch, every function call that mattered.
And the overhead. We talk about the risk of bloat.
The dynamic instruction overhead, the number of extra instructions actually executed, was less than 2.5%.
So to save 13.8% of your performance, you pay a 2.5% tax.
That is a trade-off any engineer would take in a heartbeat. The ROI is massive.
And the storage cost? The size of the binary?
The static binary size increased by somewhere between 0.01% and 1%. It's negligible. Disk space is cheap. CPU cycles are expensive.
Did it work across the board? Or was search just some special case?
It was consistent. Ads matching, knowledge graph, even standard benchmarks like Spec CPU 2006, like Pearl Bench and Gobbink. They saw 91% to 96% coverage everywhere.
Why? Why is it so universally effective?
Because it targets the fundamental weakness of the hardware. Hardware looks at the now. It sees the last 5 or 10 instructions. Software, via AS and DB, looks at the forever. It sees the aggregated history of billions and billions of executions. It doesn't matter if it's Perl or C++ or Search. The patterns of where the code goes are embedded in that history.
It's the difference between driving with headlights versus driving with a GPS that knows the whole road.
That's it, exactly. Headlights, that's hardware prefetching, only show you the next 50 feet. The GPS that software prefetching knows there's a sharp left turn in 2 miles.
So let's synthesize this. We started with an invisible tax. We found that hardware is blind to distant branches. We found that by using fleet-wide data, using AsmDB, and a clever graph traversal algorithm, we can inject breadcrumbs into the code.
And if we can convince chipmakers to build a simple ghost instruction to follow those breadcrumbs, we can reclaim almost all of that lost performance.
This brings us to the so what. What does this mean for the future of computing?
Well, I think it signals a shift in responsibility. For decades, the mantra was hardware handles performance, software handles logic. We expected Intel and AMD to build these magical branch predictors that solved all our latency problems.
But this paper suggests we've reached the limit of that philosophy.
We have. Hardware predictors are hitting diminishing returns. They're incredibly complex, they consume huge amounts of power, and they take up valuable silicon area, and yet they still fail on these massive workloads because they just lack context.
So the provocative thought to end on, if software can achieve 96% coverage, do we need the complex hardware anymore?
That is the billion-dollar question. If you have this system, could you actually simplify the CPU, Could you rip out the massive branch target buffers? Could you simplify the out-of-order execution engine?
A lobotomized front end.
Exactly. A dumb, fast front end that just blindly follows the instructions the software gives it. Go here, then fetch this. No guessing.
If you did that, you would save silicon area. You could pack more cores onto the chip. You would save a ton of power.
And you might actually end up with a faster system overall. It challenges this fundamental idea that the CPU needs to be smart. Maybe the CPU just needs to be obedient, and the smarts should live in the compiler and the data center profile.
It's the ultimate example of software eating the world. Even the CPU architecture itself is being replaced by software intelligence.
It's a fascinating future to think about.
That brings us to the end of this deep dive. We've gone from 76 cycles of latency all the way to the potential redesign of the modern processor.
It's been a journey.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you in the next deep dive.
Goodbye.